Hi, this is Tim Keel. Welcome to the Jacobsville Podcast. For this week's sermon, or any of the sermons in our archive, subscribe for free in iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Jacobs Well is a church that relies on the support of its community. We consider you a part of that community, and we'd love for you to participate with us in our financial life. You can do that on our website and in the Jacobs Well mobile app. Whether you're new to this space or a regular podritioner, we're glad you're here.
Lord, catch me off guard today. Surprise me with some moment of beauty or pain so that at least for the moment, I may be startled into seeing that you are here in all your splendor, always and everywhere, barely hidden, beneath, beyond, within this life I breathe. One day, a long time ago, back to the first century, there we go, that's it. There were great, big, important things happening in the world. There were wars being fought and territories being conquered. There were terrorists and refugees in war-torn parts of the world. There were powerful government officials making policy decisions. There were incredibly intense athletic championships at stake. Nope, that's the wrong one too. There we go, that's it. And in the midst of all of the noise and all of the distraction in the world, and the tragic news reports, God slipped into the world, almost unnoticed. And not as some were expecting, as a military leader, or as some heavenly messenger donned with glowing robes, but instead as a vulnerable infant. No, that's not the way babies are, I know that. That's way too calm. No, that one is too sparkly and blonde. Why are baby Jesus images always blonde? No, this baby was from a specific place, from a Middle Eastern place. What would that look like? Maybe that. Or maybe something like that. Or that. God entered the world on that day into the trembling hands of a young woman as a flesh and blood infant in a specific place. And the place mattered to God. And I have to hit pause in our story right there because I think for us, sometimes it's hard to understand that, why a place would matter so much. For the ancient Israelites, the place mattered a lot. The land mattered a lot. But for us now, we are way more mobile and transient in our culture now, and we don't quite get the same dependency on the land that they would have, right? Because for ancient Israelites, they were highly aware of their dependency on the land for survival. If there was a season of famine, that meant that they didn't eat for a while, yes? And not just that, it wasn't just about their survival, but it was about their identity. The land was about their identity as a people. Maybe their relationship to the land would have sounded something like this, that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, and God cares for us and provides for us from the land, food for us and for our animals. And not just that, but God has chosen us as God's chosen people and has given us a promised land. And so when we are in control of the land, that means that that is a sign that we are in covenant with God and all is well and as it should be. But the converse of that is true too. When we are not in control of the land or when we are in exile and out of the land, something has gone terribly wrong in our covenant with God. And at the time when God entered the world as this vulnerable infant, Israel was not in control of the land. In fact, they hadn't been in control of the land for several hundred years. They were scattered all over the map. And in fact, if you were to pick up your Bible and open it up and look at the books of the Old Testament, the last third of the Old Testament are all prophetic books. And the prophets, you guys, are deeply interested in Israel's relationship to the land. Because you can kind of divide the messages of the prophets into these two categories, okay? So the first category are judgments and warnings. And the judgments and warnings are directed at Israel. They are God's messengers sent to God's people to say, wake up, snap out of it. You have forgotten that you are the people whom I love and whom I have chosen to be a light in this world. And so oftentimes, those messages of judgment and warning are for all of the people because they've gotten distracted and have started worshiping the gods of the nations who are around them. But other times, those messages of judgment and warning are directed specifically at the rulers and the rich and the powerful and the leaders, because they are supposed to be the ones looking out for the most vulnerable among them, right? For the poor, for the kids without parents, for the widows who had no protection in that society, for the refugees, for the strangers among them, and they weren't doing their job. And so the prophets would go to the people and say, if you don't change, if you don't take an honest appraisal of what is going on here and change, you are going to get kicked out of the land. So that's the first category, judgment and warning. But there's a second category, too, of prophetic messages, and those are messages of hope. And those are God saying to God's people that no matter how bad things look, no matter how far away you feel from me, no matter how scattered you are still my covenant people. And I still love you, and I will send a rescuer for you. And so here's the really crazy thing, is that when you flip the page over from the last page of the Old Testament and flip it over to the first page of the New Testament, there is the gospel writer of Matthew, and it's like he's waving his arms and screaming like, the Messiah is here. That rescuer that we have been talking about and longing for all along is here. And it is in this small child. And he takes these prophetic messages of hope and he points them at this baby. And so as Jim mentioned, we are going to be looking at these four prophetic messages of hope in the opening chapters of Matthew this Advent season. And here's the really weird thing, is that these prophetic messages, they aren't aimed at people, they're aimed at places. And so we're going to be treating these places not as objects, but as subjects, as places with deep and rich history where God has been doing a specific kind of work for a really long time. And so we're going to start, the first place we're looking at today is Bethlehem. And so push play again on this story, right? That God has entered the world as a flesh and blood infant into the trembling hands of a young woman in a specific place, and that place is Bethlehem, which made absolutely no sense. Because the Israelites, they were longing for a rescuer, yes, but they were not looking for that rescuer to come from Bethlehem, because at the heart of the land, the promised land of Israel, is a city, but it's not Bethlehem, is it? What city is it? Jerusalem. Why? What's in Jerusalem that makes it so special? The temple, exactly. The temple is supposed to be the place that houses the very presence of God. And it's also the center of worship. And so it's where all the hopes are resting of the people of Israel in this city, right? And not only that, but the most important book of prophecy in all of the Old Testament is this gigantic book of Isaiah. And right at the heart of the book of Isaiah is chapter 60. And the whole chapter, you guys, is dedicated to the city of Jerusalem that is supposed to be at the heart, the place where God's rescue will start. Here's a little bit of the text from that passage. The Redeemer will come to Zion. And you guys, Zion there, that is another name in the Old Testament for Jerusalem. The Redeemer will come to Zion, to those in Jacob who repent of their sins, declares the Lord. Your sun will never set again, and your moon will wane no more. The Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of sorrow will end. Then all your people will be righteous. And read this last line out loud with me. And they will possess the land forever. And so if you are an Israelite living in the first century and you are longing, along with everyone else, for the Romans who are in control, if you are longing for a rescuer, where are you looking for that rescue to come from? You're looking to Jerusalem. That is the most obvious place for a rescuer to come. But that is not what God chooses to do. Because God has been secretly knitting together underneath Israel's story this hope in this totally unexpected place, this surprising place for over 1,000 years. And now the moment has come. God chooses Bethlehem instead. Bethlehem, it's a village at that point of around 1,000 people, as opposed to Jerusalem, which would have had at least 600,000, if not more, people living in it. Bethlehem, that looked just like every other of the hundreds of agricultural and shepherding communities all around it. There is nothing unique about it. It is completely just this little podunk town in the middle of lots of little podunk towns. Nothing special. But I'm going to geek out on you for just a minute here, and please stay with me about the history of Bethlehem, because you guys, this week it just kind of knocked my socks off. It's all these stories that we know about in the Old Testament, and they happened in this unexpected place, okay? See if you're as surprised as I am at what God has been doing all along in this narrative of this tiny little town. So it starts out in this kind of ironic way, because Bethlehem, the name actually means a house of bread. But the first time that we learn about Bethlehem in any significant way is that a famine has spread across the land, and so Bethlehem is caught in the midst of this famine, and so its citizens are leaving the city off in search for food. And one family in particular, they make the journey really far, and they head all the way to the area of Moab, which means that they would have had to have crossed the Jordan River and climbed a mountain range to get there. And so this family, they finally kind of settle in, and the sons in the family, they find wives there in Moab, and it looks as if things might finally be looking up for this family. But then tragedy strikes again, and the father dies, leaving Naomi, an elderly woman, as a widow. And then, you guys, things just get worse, because their two sons die as well, which means that they are now a family of widows. And as I've mentioned in other sermons before, that is probably the worst possible position that you can be in as a woman in this society. Because as soon as the male dies, all of the property and everything goes to the next living male relative, and there are none in this family. So for Naomi, it looks as though hope has run dry for her. But then this, like, completely startling thing happens in this story. When her daughter-in-law, Ruth, who is a Moabite, decides to stick by her side. And you guys, it would have made so much more practical sense for her to stay in Moab and find somebody else to marry there to provide for her. But she makes this, like, shocking choice of steadfast love and of care to go with Naomi back to Naomi's homeland of Bethlehem, to accompany her there and to take care of her. And it made me wonder this week, like, can you imagine what God must have been feeling looking at this young widow who has made this self-sacrificial and incredibly brave choice? Can you imagine? Like, picture them in your head, this elderly widow leaning on the shoulders of this younger widow and making that journey back through the Jordan River over a mountain range to get back to Bethlehem, and they are just hoping once they get there that someone will show them kindness, but they don't even know who. Because Israel had written in its commandments specific instructions on how to treat widows. Here's one of the instructions here. When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, meaning when you're out there picking up all of the food out of the fields and you forget something behind there, don't go back and pick it up. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. But as I mentioned, not all people in Israel were taking those commandments seriously. They were not all providing for widows in the way that they were supposed to be doing. And so Ruth heads out into the fields, which is a very dangerous place for a vulnerable woman who's looking for food. But she catches the eye, and her story reaches this man named Boaz. And he recognizes what she has done for her mother-in-law. And he says, he gets her and he brings her to him and he says this: I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And here is the shocking thing, you guys, that this is the moment when God chooses to bless Bethlehem. It is this act of generosity and self-giving love by this unexpected person, this Gentile, first of all, not expected, woman, not expected, widow, unexpected, with the tender heart that makes God go, I choose this place. Because you know the rest of the story, right? Ruth and Boaz end up getting married, and they have a son named Obed. And Obed lives in Bethlehem as well for his life. And then Obed, he grows up, and he has a son named Jesse. And Jesse also stays in the land of Bethlehem and raises his family there, a family of 8 sons. And generation after generation, this is happening day in, day out, people going to work, caring for the crops, tending their fields, taking care of their sheep, eat, sleep, wake, repeat. But then all of a sudden, this man named Samuel, who is a prophet and the right hand man of King Saul, comes into town because God has whispered into Samuel's ear that a new king has arrived and you need to go to Bethlehem to find him. Bethlehem? You can almost hear the disbelief in Samuel's voice. Like, are you sure? Nothing happens there. You sure you got that right? He probably had to pull out a map to even find where it was. But out of obedience, Samuel goes to Bethlehem. And he asks Jesse to make him a meal. He shows up at his door and he says, hey, can I meet your sons? And so you know the rest of the story, right? Jesse brings out his 8 sons, and each one, the first son comes out and he's the most obvious. He's the strong, smart guy. He's the jock. He's the guy that everybody's looking towards. He has king written all over him. But Samuel's like, no, that's not the one. Because God says, you're looking at the outward appearance, but I'm looking at the heart. And so he says no to each one of Jesse's sons. And then finally he says, don't you have any other sons? And he says, well, I've got one more, but he's just the youngest. And he's the one out doing the garbage chores right now. He's out tending the sheep in the fields. And as you know, David is the one who God chooses. And we all know the story of David, which I think sometimes makes it hard to remember what a shocking decision this is, that God chose the most overlooked kid in a family from a no-name town to be the most significant ruler in Israel's history. And because he goes on to live such a significant life, I think it's so easy to remember that he came from such humble origins. It is so easy to forget Bethlehem, and that is just what happens. Everybody forgets. Bethlehem goes on to be conquered along with the rest of the southern kingdom. And everyone turns their eyes where? To Jerusalem, for their hope to be fulfilled, longing for a rescuer, longing for something to happen. And for hundreds of years, everyone forgot about the small village of Bethlehem. Everyone, that is, except for God. One day, a seemingly insignificant young woman from out of the area, exhausted from travel, arrived at Bethlehem, much like Ruth nearly 1,000 years before. And in Bethlehem, she gave birth to a seemingly insignificant baby boy, much as David had entered this world in the same off-the-grid town hundreds of years before. And in that moment, God entered the world in a hush. That is, until a group of magi, royalty from another nation, came into town, much as Samuel had done years before them, because God had whispered into their ears as well, there is a king who has arrived. And naturally, they had gone to Jerusalem first in search for the king, because that's where a king would come from. But when they showed up in the courts of Herod and says, where's the new ruler? All of the scribes frantically head back to their prophetic scrolls and their messages of hope and are searching for them and realize we have been looking at Isaiah 60 all along and we have missed something. And they open up this tiny little prophetic book, the book of Micah, and they unroll it and they're staring at them at the face are these words scrawled on a scroll that say this, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Everyone else was looking towards Jerusalem, but here, 9 miles south in Bethlehem, God was preparing the soil all along for his son. As the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann puts it, they were simply off by 9 miles. I was listening to a podcast this last week, and the interviewer, she made this offhand comment, and it pertained to nothing at the moment, but the comment stuck with me all week long, and it's something I've just been chewing on. She described heaven as a place of tireless creativity. And it just hit me. The tireless creativity of our God to consistently usurp our expectations, to choose Bethlehem over Jerusalem. And out of all the people in the whole wide world that God could have chosen to put Bethlehem on the map, he chose that tender woman. And out of all the people that God could have chosen to be the ruler, he chose that overlooked shepherd boy in David. And out of all of the massive book of Isaiah that God could have chosen, instead he chose to use Micah instead. It is as if God had been smiling all along. His hand rested over the city of Bethlehem, tilling the soil, waiting for the next surprise, which I desperately need. Because the incarnation of God is the hope to which I cling. the audacity that God would take on flesh and enter the brokenness of this world, and my own brokenness included, and heal it from the inside. You guys, that is mind-boggling. That is incredible. That is shocking. And yet I hear the story over and over and over again with the shiny blonde baby Jesus, and this story loses all of its punch, which makes the Bethlehem story so important. It cries out in the midst of our distracted world, don't forget to be surprised by God. Don't get so distracted and so lost that you cannot be amazed by the way that God creatively knits these things together. And it can feel like God's silent, right? For thousands of years, it seemed as though God was silent, but there was work being done underneath the surface, ready to pop up as life all the time. Don't forget this Advent season that that is true, that the incarnation is shocking and surprising, and it happens in any no-name place, even the no-name places in our own lives. Because it is surprise, you guys, that leads to wonder, and we can be off on that by 9 miles. If we aren't cultivating wonder, because wonder is the only posture where we can enter into true praise, to adoration before a manger with a baby. And so this first week of Advent, here's an idea if you are like me and you need one, to stir this and to remember. Everybody got a candle and a match at home? That's really all you need, okay? So here's the idea. In the morning, when you wake up, light a candle. Because light, you guys, is one of the most important symbols in the season of Advent. Because it is the image of God entering into the darkness of this world as a light. And when you light that candle in the morning, pray this simple prayer. God, I anticipate being surprised by you today. And then live with that prayer all day. Be ready to be surprised by God's presence in your life in a moment of pain, or in a moment of joy, or in a moment of just the pure ordinariness of life. And not only that, but be ready to be God's light in this world. Be ready to warm God's heart with your act of steadfast love in this world. Don't forget to be surprised. Lord, catch me off guard today. Surprise me with some moment of beauty or pain, so that at least for the moment, I may be startled into seeing that you are here in all your splendor, always and everywhere, barely hidden, beneath, beyond, within this life I breathe. Amen.
This podcast is a part of Jacob's Well Church in Kansas City. Our website is jacobswellchurch.org. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/JacobsWellKC. You can find us on Instagram @JacobsWell. If you'd like to participate in our financial life, you can do that on our website and in the Jacob's Well mobile app, available in the Apple and Android app stores. May the Lord bless and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious unto you. May the Lord turn his face to you and grant you his peace. Amen.